This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New Books Network podcast in Asian American Studies. I'm your host, Donna Doan Anderson, and joining me in conversation today is Dr. Michael Jin, Associate Professor of Global Asian Studies and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Today's conversation centers Jin's book, Citizens, Immigrants, and the Stateless, The Japanese American Diaspora in the Pacific. Published in November 2021 by Stanford University Press, the book weaves together Jin's specializations in migration and diaspora studies, Asian American history, critical race and ethnic studies, and the history of the American West to examine the highly mobile trans-Pacific diaspora of roughly 50,000 Nisei, or second-generation Japanese Americans, moving between the Japanese Empire and the American West. The book traverses these deeply intertwined histories of Asian exclusion, colonialism in Asia, and the volatile geopolitical changes regarding citizenship and migration in the Asia-Pacific during the 20th century. Jin's research builds on an already strong scholarship interrogating the impacts of World War II on Japanese Americans by providing interventions that push the spatial boundaries of Asian American studies. I'm particularly compelled by Jin's introduction to a diasporic framework to conceptualize how Japanese Americans defined and redefined their relationships with both the United States and Japan. No doubt the topics of citizens, immigrants, and the stateless make Michael Jin a valuable member of the Diaspora Studies Cluster at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Further, he previously served as an advisor to the National Japanese American Historical Society's Teacher Education Program. In addition to this service, Jin is also a member of the advisory group for the Illinois State Board of Education in support of implementing the Teaching Equitable Asian American Community History Act, or TEACH Act, the 2021 legislation that made Illinois the first state to require the teaching of Asian American history in public schools. His new blog, The Stuttering Professor, shares how his lifelong struggle with a speech disorder has influenced his academic career, his approaches to teaching, and his engagements in interdisciplinary dialogues on accessibility and social justice. Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us in the conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So I'll just start with my first question, which is very open-ended, get us situated into the topics of your book. So how did you come to write this book and on this topic more specifically? And as you have a wide variety of sources, how did you balance your interrogations from both the United States and Japan?
Yeah, the life of this book began many years ago. As a master's thesis, actually, when I was studying at the University of California, Santa Cruz, I had a ridiculously naive and ambitious goal of rewriting the history of the World War II Japanese-American incarceration and transforming the field through my master's thesis project. I had no idea what I was doing, obviously. One thing I knew, though, was that the Japanese-American wartime experience is arguably the most widely taught and researched subject within Asian American studies. So what I wanted to do was to look at the stories of people who could offer a different perspective on this watershed in 20th century U.S. history. During my research, I met a group of retired gardeners in West Los Angeles. They were Los Angeles natives, but they had left their hometown in the 1930s to seek better lives in Japan. Then they came back to LA right before the Pacific War in 1941. Collectively, they became known as Kibei, which in Japanese means those who came back to America. This is one of the terms that I use throughout my book. One of the gentlemen that I met took a great interest in my project. He took me to his favorite West LA restaurant for chop suey and shared his story with me. I'll call him Mr. K. His first name is Hiroshi. Mr. K grew up in Okinawa and returned to his hometown of LA as a young high school graduate right before Pearl Harbor. He spoke English with a heavy Japanese accent. When the war broke out, his entire family was uprooted from home and spent the war in the incarceration camp. Throughout the war, he and other Kibei American citizens who spoke English with a Japanese accent had to live with the stigma of being too Japanese and therefore potentially pro-Japan. They were under constant surveillance and their thoughts and behaviors policed. And there was even a speculation that they would be separated from the rest of the Japanese American population and placed in a segregated prison camp. But the U.S. government drafted Mr. K into the army anyway, out of the Manzanar incarceration camp in 1944, despite his perceived disloyalty and excessive Japanese-ness, and shipped him to the Pacific Theater to serve as a linguist. And that was the only wartime context in which his Japanese upbringing and his fluency in Japanese was valued, of course, as an asset for the American war effort against Japan. Mr. K eventually landed on Okinawa, where he had spent his childhood before the war, as a member of the U.S. occupation force in 1945. And when he came home to Los Angeles after the war as a decorated veteran, he found himself once again a target of the lingering anti-Japanese hostility and the intense Cold War era anti-Asian xenophobia and the continued ostracization from his own community for still being to Japanese. So he told me all this rather casually over our chop suey dinner, but he also added that he had never really shared that part of his life with his children and grandchildren. And what I realized much later was that he and others like him had been waiting for a long time to tell their stories, the stories that defy the dominant historical memory of the Japanese-American experience, centering on a narrow conceptualization of national loyalty and Americanism. There is a well-known narrative of Japanese-Americans as patriotic victims of wartime racism who nevertheless proved their loyalty through their active cooperation with the U.S. government, overcame racial hysteria, and quietly rebuilt their community after the war and fulfilled the promise of American democracy. And that is a quintessential Asian American model minority thesis. It is emotionally satisfying and powerfully appealing narrative that played an important role in the post-war Japanese American redress movement, which culminated in a truly rare achievement of compelling the U.S. government to issue an official apology and reparations for the wartime injustice. But this kind of one-dimensional representation of Japanese Americans has pushed the complex transnational experiences of U.S.-born Japanese American migrants like Mr. K to the margins of history and silenced their voices for many decades, even after the war. I found more Nisei men and women like Mr. K, who were American citizens by birth, but spent their formative years as migrants in Japan and Japanese colonies in Asia throughout the first half of the 20th century. And many of them came back to be treated like enemies. And they represented at least a quarter of the population of the U.S.-born Japanese Americans before the war. That's one in four. And what this means is that almost every Japanese American family had someone like Mr. K. My question then was, why was it that I had heard so little about them? So I decided to write in my master's thesis about what the World War II Japanese American incarceration meant from the perspectives of these kibei and how the presence of this large contingent of transnational individuals within the Japanese American community had fundamentally shaped the U.S. government's policy of mass incarceration throughout the war. And that master's thesis, although it was an utterly inadequate and incomplete mess, became the foundation for my book project. And it's actually chapter three of the book. Since that second year in graduate school, I've worked backwards to explore the complex life experiences like those of those like Mr. K and how the regime of racial oppression in the United States, the anti-Asian xenophobia that had intimately shaped all race-based legal, cultural, social, and political institutions of the Jim Crow era American West, compelled so many young U.S.-born Japanese Americans to leave their homes and become migrants in their parents' homeland in the first place. And displaced them throughout the Japanese Empire. And to answer the second part of your question, as my book shows, I am drawn to stories. Stories that are deeply personal and yet incredibly complex, unexpected, and unpredictable, and ultimately define conventional narratives. And these stories help me think differently about the concepts that can be taken for granted, like citizenship, nationalism, identity, ethnicity, loyalty, etc. How do different historical circumstances and geographical, political and temporal context demand different interpretations of these concepts beyond national narratives? This is a big question that I was trying to grapple with by looking at a very specific group or subgroup of American-born Nisei. So my approach was to focus more narrowly on how their position as Americans, Americans of Japanese ancestry more specifically, shaped their distinct role in the Japanese colonial world as diasporic individuals, and at the same time complicated their subjectivity as citizens and as members of an ethnic group in the U.S. context. One of the challenges that I faced was locating and analyzing sources that are sporadic, and I had to work with whatever I could find. So I started by looking at sources that other historians had already looked at. Immigration files, wartime documents, Japanese American community papers, court documents, and oral histories, to see how these sources actually tell us different stories. What are some of the stories that were overlooked? And many archival sources that I work with actually tell us quite a bit about the Nisei who left the United States and lived in the Japanese Empire and about those who came back. Sometimes we just need to look more closely. Here was a group of US-born Asian Americans who lived in a fundamentally multilingual and multicultural, transnational, and trans-imperial world. And as soon as I decided after that second year in graduate school that I wanted to pursue a research topic in their history, I knew that I had to work closely with Japanese language sources, and I had to go to Japan. In Japan, again, I started by looking at places that other scholars had looked at. For example, I went to the diplomatic archives at the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs to look at documents that provide critical information about the role of Nisei in Japan's cosmopolitan empire. So I benefited from the work of scholars in both the United States and Japan who have excavated and worked with these sources. But my own transnational research is also part of that collective project of developing a growing body of primary sources in both countries and in both languages that will help us understand the variety of Japanese American life experiences in both the US and Japanese empires. And I want to say that, and I state this in my book, what my research delivers is far from the most definitive or comprehensive history of Nisei's transnational experiences. I never set out to make that kind of bold claim. My strategy instead was to focus on stories and case studies that I find most compelling and use them to think differently about how the anti-Asian xenophobia in the American West, Japanese colonialism in Asia, and volatile U.S.-Japan relations that culminated in the war converged in their lives. And this is a book about how they responded to and negotiated these historical changes in different ways. So some of the places that I went to and spent a lot of time to do research are places that have materials that focus exclusively on individual stories. For example, I went to a rather obscure folklore museum in a small town called Kajiki in southern Kagoshima Prefecture to learn more about a Nisei who grew up there in the 1910s and 1920s during the period called the Taisho era in modern Japanese history. That really transformed my research in terms of understanding how even the traces of the mundaneness of someone's life in that obscure, small coastal village can be situated within a variety of Japanese and US social, political, and cultural contexts. And this is the story of David Akira Itami in chapter 4 of my book. So that was my main approach, to look carefully at whatever is available and to search for traces of the past that would allow me to weave these personal stories together and contextualize them in some meaningful ways.
Yeah, and that sounds, I mean, I was so compelled when I was reading your book. I hadn't read anything quite like it before. And so I think, one, it's so encouraging to hear that this started as a master's thesis project and that it has continued for many years since then, you know, because that kind of consistency, I feel like is really encouraging to hear. But then also this notion of telling these stories of individuals who had been waiting a really long time to see their perspectives reflected in a very, like you mentioned, well-studied and you know, quite expansive scholarship that's on Japanese Americans in Asian American history. So I guess the story about Mr. K that you've introduced us to brings us a little bit to the questions that you're asking in the first chapter. And I'll take a quote from that first chapter. You say, What made the diasporic identity of many Japanese American migrants unique was that their life in Japan, their purported diasporic homeland, was an extension of their American experience. Would you be able to elaborate on how Japanese Americans went from citizens to immigrants in the years before World War II?
I look at the transnational displacement of Japanese Americans as a long-term consequence of the Asian exclusion movement in the early 20th century in the U.S. So this is very much an American story to me. I was always interested in ways that the anti-immigrant sentiment that intimately shaped the regime of the Jim Crow era racial exclusion in the American West directly contributed to the white nationalist attack on the institution of birthright citizenship more broadly. There were concerted efforts in California and other Western states throughout the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s, for instance, to strip the citizenship rights of the U.S.-born children of Japanese immigrants. And this contributed directly to the dismal socioeconomic outlook for many Nisei in America. And many of them saw the rising Japanese empire as a place where they could pursue socioeconomic mobility and maybe fulfill the broken promise of American dream. So my interest lied primarily in looking at how the anti-Asian sentiment and various exclusionary legal measures designed to stop the influx of Asian migrants based on the Orientalist representation of Asians as perpetual foreigners and a danger to the socioeconomic well-being of white America did much more than exclude the immigrant generation from American citizenry. And I've always thought that the most consequential impact of the anti-immigrant sentiment and the politics of xenophobia was, and I think it is still to this day, the threat to their U.S.-born children's future in this country. So the transnational displacement of Nisei during the first half of the 20th century was one of the bizarre consequences of that powerful culture and politics of xenophobia in the United States. And my book's examination of the Nisei migrants' diasporic engagement with the U.S. and Japan starts in that context of the Jim Crow American West. Many years ago, I read a memoir written by one of the Nisei migrants who was a Southern California native. He went to live in Tokyo in the late 1930s and ended up staying in Japan permanently. And he wrote, we were seeking better lives for ourselves. Not in America, but in Japan. I read it as a powerful statement that defied the American dream narrative, which had completely failed these young Americans of Japanese ancestry. So this is a story about people who used transnational migration as a powerful way to claim their agency and as a way to overcome their rightlessness in their own country. So again, that's where I started. And I traced their movements and their experiences across national and colonial borders of the Pacific world, from the early 20th century American West to the Japanese colonial frontiers, from small rural towns in Kyushu to the cityscapes of Tokyo, and from World War II incarceration camps in America to the city of Hiroshima on the eve of the atomic bombing, and back to the United States again as migrants during the Cold War decades. And I followed their transnational journeys in archives and a variety of historical memories that revealed to me how these migrants drew the American West into the larger histories of nations and empires in the Pacific world. because this is not simply a linear immigrant narrative of Nisei's escape from the United States to Japan. Their relocation to the Japanese Empire was not the end, but only the beginning of the story. Once they left their homes in the American West, what they encountered was a world that was intimately shaped by the exigencies of geopolitical changes and shifting U.S.-Japan relations. Despite their hopeful imagination of Japan and the Japanese Empire as a place that would allow them to pursue the kind of freedom and social mobility that their country of birth had denied them, these migrants often found themselves mired in a series of bizarre and tragic events at the crossroads of U.S. and Japanese empires, which of course culminated in a tragic war in 1941. And although they were on the other side of the ocean, they continued to engage with the United States, and their lives were inevitably and intimately tied to their families, friends, and loved ones back in the United States. So what happened in the U.S. still mattered. And at the same time, their lives were forever altered by the developments in Asia and beyond, from the global Great Depression to Japan's imperialist war in Asia, to the Second Sino-Japanese War and the Japanese settler colonialism in Manchuria, and to the war with the United States. And these global historical events offered some of these young Japanese American migrants a lot of opportunities, but simultaneously devastated the lives of many more of them. And many of them continued to grapple with what it meant for them to live as American citizens of Japanese ancestry, pretty much wherever they went.
Yeah, that makes, thank you for that clarification and all the wonderful examples. I love this notion of like rethinking movement and immigration outside of linear narratives. And so I think you, and you had also mentioned in your description a little bit about the notion of rightlessness, right? What does it mean to be Japanese American, though a citizen of the United States, but still rightless in your own country? And I think that's where chapter two really spends some time highlighting some of the key interrogations around what actually rightless means. And so I'm wondering if you could maybe talk through how you emphasize immigration law, particularly as it shifts on both sides of the Pacific and its impacts on the transnational Nisei, which I know you're already getting at in that last question, but perhaps an example of how this actually plays out and how Japanese Americans, despite, say, their citizenship in the United States, could become rightless citizens beyond just, say, the political movements to try and strip them of their birthright citizenship.
Yes. This is a part of the story of the life in Japan being an extension of their American experience, because although they were away from the United States, they often found themselves still subject to racist legislation and exclusionary politics in the United States. There were a number of ways in which the Japanese-American migrants became stateless. And I use the concept of statelessness both in the legal sense as well as in the cultural and political context. And the group that I focus on in Chapter 2 are young Nisei women who lived in Japan and Japanese colonies during the 1920s and 1930s, whose experiences exposed a long-term crisis that the Japanese-American migrants had to confront as a result of the unexpected impact of the U.S. government's immigration and nationality policies during the first half of the 20th century. The case study that I use in that chapter is about a California native Nisei woman named Toshiko Inaba, who grew up in her uncle's house in Kumamoto Prefecture in the 1920s. And she decided to leave Japan and return to her hometown near Sacramento in 1928 at the age of 20, only to be denied entry by the U.S. immigration authorities at Angel Island. They declared that she was no longer a U.S. citizen and instead a person of a race ineligible to citizenship and not admissible to U.S. soil. And she was deported to Japan 16 months later. What happened was that during the entry interviews, the immigration officials learned that she had married a Japanese citizen against her will while she had lived in Japan, and she had that marriage annulled in the eyes of Japanese family law. But U.S. immigration officials invoked two federal laws that Congress had passed while she was in Japan to strip her U.S. citizenship and reject her entry application and banish her from her country of birth. The first law they enforced was the Cable Act of 1922, and this was a law that repealed the Expatriation Act of 1907, which had forced any American woman marrying a foreign national to forfeit her U.S. citizenship and assume the citizenship of her husband. The Cable Act of 1922 purported to protect an American woman's birthright citizenship regardless of her husband's national origin. But the Cable Act made a critical exception to this women's right to independent citizenship by continuing to strip U.S. citizenship from American women like Toshiko Inaba, who married the so-called aliens ineligible for citizenship, namely Asian men. And this glaring loophole in the Cable Act allowed the U.S. Bureau of Immigration to declare that Inaba had essentially given up her American citizenship by virtue of her marriage to a Japanese citizen. So that's how she lost her U.S. citizenship. The second law that the U.S. immigration officials invoked was the Immigration Act of 1924, which effectively made her an illegal alien because this law barred admission of the so-called aliens ineligible for citizenship or immigrants from Asia. After revoking her U.S. citizenship, the officials at Angel Island reclassified her legal status as a stateless individual, then as an illegal immigrant from Japan. So here was an example of the consequential impact of the long history of Asian exclusion on Japanese Americans' birthright citizenship. What this case demonstrates is that it was the Japanese American women living abroad who became the most vulnerable victims of exclusionary U.S. policies. And so even after these Nisei citizens relocated to the Japanese Empire to escape anti-Japanese sentiment, the U.S. regime of racial exclusion demonstrated power to strip their birthright citizenship because of their life choices while they were away from home. But the most compelling aspect of the story to me is that this young woman fought her way to the U.S. Federal court to assert her independent birthright citizenship and her right to rejoin her family back in California, and how she had to negotiate both Japanese and U.S. legal and cultural institutions to articulate and reclaim her identity as an American citizen. She filed a series of appeals while she was imprisoned on Angel Island for 16 months, which actually made her the longest detainee from Japan in the history of the Angel Island immigration station. And she eventually lost her case, and she was deported to Japan. It would take her 35 years until 1965 to finally return to the United States legally as a Japanese immigrant, and she lived the rest of her life in Sacramento as a naturalized citizen of the United States until she died in 1981. There is a long history of the Fierce Natives campaign to strip U.S.-born Asian Americans of their birthright citizenship throughout the 19th century and early 20th century. There were a number of well-known cases like United States versus Wong Kim Ark in 1898. But what the Toshiko Inaba case tells us is that that exclusionary movement had finally come to fruition in the 1920s when racist legislation stripped the birthright citizenship of Nisei migrants, and more specifically Nisei women who had gone to Japan. Another gendered dimension to the vulnerability of Nisei migrants' birthright citizenship was that there were thousands of Japanese American men who were dual citizens and served in the Japanese armed forces during the Pacific War. And many of them were conscripted into the Japanese military, and they were forced to bear arms against their country of birth, often against their will. But as a result of their service to the Japanese emperor, they automatically lost their U.S. citizenship based on the Nationality Act of 1940. And it would take many of them pains to recover their American citizenship after the war, because the onus was on them to prove that they were compelled to serve in the Japanese military against their will. So both in terms of legal and cultural terms, there many Japanese Americans, because of their actions and decisions and because of the forces beyond their own power, became stateless in a variety of contexts.
Yeah, that's, I think, both thinking about immigration in the gendered aspect, but also in this notion of putting, you know, Nisei in the position where they have to negotiate and prove to the United States or Japan, right, various in whatever context of their situations, demonstrates, like you said, this really fascinating interrogation and understanding of both the cultural and political context of both spaces that they belong to. And I think when we get to the wartime years, as you're alluding to at the end of your statement, which is, you know, how do Nisei who are serving in the Japanese military during the wartime years kind of negotiate and explain their participation is a really fascinating angle. So I guess the next few questions for me are going to focus on the wartime years, right? When the United States and Japan are at war and how this is directly impacting this transnational Nisei class that you're talking about. And I really, really enjoyed chapters 3 and 4. Like, I found them to be, and to also find out that chapter 3 was the master's project. I mean, wow, blowing my mind, truly. So to think about chapters 3 and 4 together, which is really analyzing the role of the Kibei during World War II, and, you know, how their developmental years abroad are both used against them, but then also used to kind of propel them to other social statuses, right? And so I would like maybe for listeners who are maybe unfamiliar with what the Kibei class is, would you be able to explain how the Kibei in your construction or in your kind of interrogations of the book are a politically and culturally constructed category to deflect from, say, Nisei loyalty and the Nisei loyalty problem?
Yeah. Do, during the war, many of the Kibei were stigmatized as those who returned from Japan with a cultural baggage of being too Japanese, as I briefly talked about when I introduced Mr. K's story. Many of them spoke English with a Japanese accent because they had been educated in Japan and spent many years in that country, as well as in Japanese colonies in Asia. And after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the U.S. government treated these Kibei as a potentially dangerous and pro-Japan element within the Japanese-American community. And there are reports prepared by the military intelligence officers, for example, who even suggested that Kibei should be treated just like the Nazi sympathizers, for example, in the United States, and they should be separated from the Japanese American community. So there was even a suggestion to separate the Kibei, and more specifically, the male Kibei bachelors, which is a term used by the U.S. government's War Relocation Authority, the agency in charge of managing the 10 incarceration camps from the rest of the Japanese American population. And that was based on the perception that the Kibei, by virtue of their education and their upbringing and their extended stay in Japan, were essentially Japanese in their cultural and political disposition. And therefore, they must be perpetually loyal to the Japanese emperor. And these Kibei were also ostracized by their own community during the war. Many among the Japanese American community leaders who actively cooperated with the U.S. government's incarceration policy identified Kibei as a group that could potentially tarnish the image of the rest of the Japanese American community as loyal Americans because of the sweeping representation of the Kibei as essentially Japanese, in spite of their American citizenship by birth. And this compelled many Japanese Americans to reject anything that could be perceived as Japanese and sever their ties to Japan. And this intense rejection of Japan resulted in the active suppression of Kibei's voices throughout the war years and for many decades after the war. So there was enormous social and political pressure on the Japanese American community as a whole. And the war engendered almost complete polarization between things Japanese and things American. But of course, as Mr. K's case tells us, the exigencies of war made Kibei's linguistic abilities and their knowledge of Japanese culture also valuable to the U.S. government when they served as translators and interpreters in the U.S. intelligence warfare in the Pacific theater. Outside that specific context of their martial duty, the Kibei would remain a category that served as the antithesis to loyal and assimilated and Americanized Nisei.
Yeah, and speaking of translators, I think that's where David Akira Itami's story comes in, which is something you mentioned in the opening statement. And I'm hoping we could potentially revisit him, because as you analyze in chapter 4 about his life and his roles, and then particularly how his experience was then co-opted and perhaps like romanticized in Japan through the best-selling novel, which I don't think I can pronounce the name very correctly, but I will attempt so, Futatsu no Shokoku. And also this television series that was created based off of this novel, right? And so as we have talked about, right, the kibei as a politically and culturally constructed category was kind of used not only to determine loyalty, but also to kind of create this notion of allegiance, right? How does David Akira Itami's life and then his romanticized counterpart in the novel, Kenji Amo, demonstrate how kibei were also employed in similar ways in Japan, or how they were used to propel certain narratives on the other side of the Pacific?
Yeah, the Itami story is something that I find very compelling and also very troubling, because not only does it open a window into the complex trans-Pacific lives of Japanese American migrants, but it also reveals the power of historical memories in shaping the post-war debates about loyalty, allegiance, and national identity in both countries, as you mentioned. So I'll talk a bit about both of those aspects of the story. So David Akira Itami's life, I think, offers a social history of Nisei migrants' diasporic world. He was born in Oakland, California, and he grew up in southern Kagoshima Prefecture in Japan in the 1910s and 1920s. And it was a period in which Japan had undergone unprecedented political liberalism and social unrest. And at the same time, Japan was expanding as a colonial empire. And he returned to the United States in the early 1930s as a young man who had developed a unique perspective on Japan and the Japanese Empire. And he would go through his life as a kibei in the 1930s and 1940s. He was a young factory worker at one point, and he became quite a well-known journalist in the Japanese American community, and he also became a community leader. He was once accused by Japanese-American leftists for writing columns that looked sympathetic to Japanese imperialism in Asia. But when the war broke out, he transformed into a model American patriot. He volunteered to serve as an Army language instructor out of Manzanar. He joined the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Service, and he translated some 4,000 Japanese wartime documents. And he won the Legion of Merit Award for his service. Then he went on to join the U.S. Occupation Force in post-war Japan and served as a chief language monitor at the Tokyo War Crimes Trials. He then committed suicide while he was stationed in Tokyo. So his story shows how both modern Japanese and U.S. history, as well as global history, actively shaped the diasporic lives of Nisei migrants. But it also complicates the notions about Japanese American loyalty and their national allegiance. David Itami's tragic life became a model for Japanese writer Yamasaki Toyoko's novel, Futatsu no Sokoku, which means two homelands, and it was published in 1982, and it became serialized as a popular NHK TV drama in 1983 called Sangamoi, which can be translated as Mountains and Rivers Are Burning. And Yamasaki's depiction of the main character, Kenji Amo, was modeled after David Itami, is that the kibei soldier's true allegiance was to his diasporic home, which is Japan, right? And where he was raised as someone steeped in the traditional Japanese virtue of loyalty. And it was because of his Japanese upbringing and that he was raised as a loyal Japanese person, that he was able to serve honorably in the U.S. Army. And although he served in the U.S. Army Yamasaki's interpretation was that he suffered from deep inner conflict because his heart had really belonged to Japan. And that suffering led him to commit suicide. Now, this novel and the TV series engendered a fierce backlash in the Japanese-American community in the U.S., especially when the NHK, or Japan Broadcasting Company, announced that it would show the TV series in the U.S. market in 1984. The backlash came especially from the Japanese-American community leaders who criticized Yamasaki and NHK for the representation of a Nisei man as someone whose loyalty straddled the two nations. And this was in the midst of the Japanese-American redress movement. And the Nisei community leaders were actively promoting the image of Japanese-Americans as loyal Americans to win public support for redress legislation. Now, what is missing in this debate, of course, is David Itami's own voice. He didn't live long enough to have a voice in the controversy created by a novel based on his life. The truth is that no one knows why he took his own life. But the fact that his life, despite its enormous complexity and his death, had to be represented in popular culture and political debates in ways that reproduce the reductive notions about one's loyalty, I think really demonstrates the power of nation-centered narratives in both Japan and the United States. And that's why I find this particular case study very troubling and also powerful.
Yeah, I love the kind of bringing it back to the reductive notions of national narratives and questions around belonging and citizenship as being like, this is what's going to direct the ways that we interpret these histories and these experiences, because as we know with Itami's life, it's much more complicated than that. So I guess maybe to kind of finish up a consideration of these wartime years, I really liked how you explained that the wartime histories between two empires in Japan and the United States shared a lot about how Japanese American migrants, quote, negotiated wartime loyalties and citizenship outside of US-centered context, end quote. And so I guess this gets us back to this notion of blood right citizenship, or just sanguinis, that Yamasaki is talking about in this narrative, right? Which is what is compelling Itami's life is this pull to the diasporic homeland and this loyalty to the diasporic homeland. And so I guess this goes all the way back to what you mentioned about the Nisei soldiers who are serving in the Japanese military. And then also all of these other contexts in which, how do we deal with Nisei who are one on the side of Japan or quote on the side of the United States? How do their roles during the war impact their U.S. citizenship, and then, of course, the years of American occupation that follow the end of the war? How are they navigating that? How are they negotiating their status then?
Yeah, the war certainly altered the lives of many Nisei who were stranded in Japan. Despite their U.S. citizenship by birth, the Japanese government did not treat them as enemy aliens the way that Japanese Americans in the United States were treated during the war. So they did not go through something like mass imprisonment. Nevertheless, the Nisei in Japan faced mounting pressure to demonstrate their loyalty to Japan and serve Japanese war efforts against the Allied powers. And NISA residents in Japan responded in a variety of ways. Some men and women served in the Japanese intelligence warfare. And as I explained earlier, many NISA men served in the Japanese military. So the Japanese government did claim their loyalty, for sure. And the NISA citizenship and national allegiance became really fluid and fragile in that context. For many Nisei in Japan, as well as in the United States, being loyal to a country during wartime had much to do with survival. And they often found themselves in a position where they had little room to really negotiate their national allegiance. For many among those Nisei men and women who survived the war in Japan, their knowledge of the Japanese language and customs made them assets to American occupation after the war. So that was another context that made the fluidity and fragility of their citizenship very pronounced. Many of them served in various civil staff sections of the U.S. occupation government under the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General MacArthur. They also served as liaisons working for various Allied forces occupying different regions of Japan. And these employees of the U.S. occupation force included those Nisei men who had served in the Japanese military and lost their American citizenship as a result because of their service to the Japanese emperor. It was, in fact, their experiences as veterans of the Japanese armed forces that made them even more qualified to do the work that required the knowledge of Japanese society and the nuances of its culture. Bureaucracy, ideological institutions, etc. So the exigencies of U.S. militarism and Cold War geopolitics really blur the boundaries of national loyalty for the Nisei. And once again, it proved to be the only context where their Japanese-ness was valued.
So I guess that brings us to the final chapter of the book, which takes us out of the wartime years and into a much more contemporary moment when discussing the role of Japanese-American atomic bomb survivors. So this final chapter and its sobering analysis tells us a little bit about the lessons of the Japanese-American atomic bomb survivors and how that inspires us to think differently about how we treat, examine, and engage violence across multiple spaces. Could you tell us maybe a little bit more about, one, that narrative and what it looked like, and then perhaps what lessons we can pull and cull from that experience in moving forward?
I think the Japanese-American atomic bomb survivors' struggles for redress and historical recognition remind us that for many victims of military violence, like the nuclear holocaust in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's not just a single atrocity that defines their survival. There were thousands of U.S.-born Nisei in Hiroshima in 1945, because that city and Hiroshima prefecture happened to be the place that had sent the largest number of Japanese migrants to the U.S. So many young Nisei migrants were in Hiroshima because it was their parents' hometown. The fact that the United States dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima, in spite of the large presence of these American citizens, is not something that is often discussed or debated. Although the atomic bombing, I think, remains one of the very popular historical topics that have engendered debates on myriad moral and political implications. It's really incredible that the enormous scholarship in this history and popular culture have had little room for the inclusion of these American civilians who were trapped in Hiroshima and became victimized by the atomic bomb that was supposed to liberate the world from the Japanese Empire. And after that, these American survivors of the nuclear Holocaust became excluded from the dominant liberation narrative of the war. The U.S. government has yet to acknowledge the presence of these U.S.-born Japanese Americans who were victimized by the bomb. So in that sense, they became essentially stateless in the post-World War II regime of reparations and compensatory justice. Many of these atomic bomb survivors returned to the United States, and they led a movement to advocate for themselves and other victims of the nuclear violence. And they also led legislative campaigns in the 1970s and 1980s, which culminated in the introduction of congressional bills that would require the U.S. government to provide medical care and compensations to the American victims of the atomic bombing. Now, these bills didn't really have the chance of being passed, and they served primarily as a symbolic call for the historical recognition of these forgotten American victims of the atomic bombing. And I would also highly recommend Naoko Wake's book, American Hibakusha, which is a beautiful and very important book that documents the experiences of these people. So here again, I use the concept of statelessness in the sense that many among the Japanese American migrants who went to Japan as a way to escape from racial exclusion and xenophobia and survived the American military violence, they have continued to struggle to find a place in the narrative and historical memory of the Japanese-American experience, in spite of the fact that they you know, I think their stories offer very sort of compelling aspect of the post-war Japanese-American struggle for redress.
All right, so that kind of takes us to the final question of today's conversation, which is really getting people to see a little bit more about where your interest lies now that this book has been released. So would you be willing to share what projects you're working on and or what's inspiring you presently?
Sure, I'll be happy to. The projects that I am working on build on my book's cross-disciplinary and transnational approach to the studies on human migration and racial formation that draw from the perspectives of migrants across multiple national borders. My current research documents the experiences of Korean survivors of the nuclear Holocaust in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that revealed the legacies of Japanese colonialism, U.S. militarism, and the post-colonial politics of redress in the Pacific world. And part of this research was published in Emerasia Journal last year in a special issue on Cold War reformation. In that article, I explore the historical erasures of Korean and U.S.-born Nisei survivors of the atomic bombing. And my next book project will examine the 20th century transnational circuits of change across West Asia, East Asia, and North America that converged in the lives of Iranian and Korean migrants during the Cold War decades. And as a part of that project, I'm currently focusing on the experiences of migrants from Iran, whose journey to America was routed through their sojourn in South Korea since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. So like my first book, what is driving these projects is my interest in pushing the conceptual, linguistic, and spatial boundaries of ethnic studies and area studies across nations, regions, and empires manifested in the historically grounded experiences of people in global diasporas.
That sounds fascinating. And I'm so excited to read that work and to see how it fits into not only our understandings of world history or global histories, but Asian American studies as well. So I want to say thank you so much for your time and for your wonderful contributions that you put forth in Citizens, Immigrants, and the Stateless. I hope that many people who are listening pick up this book, read it, and enjoy all that it has to offer, because I really do think it has enormous impact on the fields that you're speaking to. So thank you, Michael, for joining me today.
Thank you so much.